thought in his mind, rather than on Emma's previous comment.
"Do you want to come round to talk for real?"
Emma asked. "I don't have to be up early tomorrow."
"What do you want to talk about?"
"Hold on until I check my list of topics," she said, laughing again. "I don't know, Dan, just whatever. It feels like I'd barely seen you recently until this Kerguelen thing, and now it's like that's all there is. We didn't always need there to be something to talk about, did we?"
"Kerguelen is a big deal, Emma. Everyone is getting distracted by Teemo and Namtso and all that stuff, but the messengers are coming back. They're coming back soon."
"I hope so. At least it'll give us something new to talk about," Emma said. There was only a hint of a chuckle in her voice this time, and Dan didn't really know how to read it.
"I'm going to go back inside," he said. "It's freezing out here. Don't stay out too long, okay?"
Emma looked up again at the stars overhead, imagining what it would look like when they did come back, and especially if they came down with their craft uncloaked.
"Can you imagine if their craft..."
Her question was interrupted by Dan's door closing behind him as he re-entered the kitchen.
"Night, Dan," she sighed.
C-74. Stevenson Farm, East View, Colorado. 3 miles south of Birchwood, Richard Walker sat pensively at the kitchen table of the cottage which had once been his second home and was now his only refuge from a hostile world. The picturesque cornfield vistas and relative privacy despite its proximity to the city had been Walker's motivations for choosing this cottage over his other options, and he had never regretted the decision for a minute. Only a handful of people knew where Walker lived, and he was equally confident for varying reasons that each would stay quiet. The first was Joe Crabb, a long-term ally who continued to deliver essential supplies every 2 weeks. Joe knew where Walker lived, but he didn't know what had happened there. He didn't know anything. Joe didn't know that Walker's cover-up was a hoax, much less that his lies had come true when real aliens furtively sabotaged DS-1's launch to prevent the nuclear weaponization of space. And Joe certainly didn't know that those aliens had taken Walker, the man whose lies led to the launch of DS-1 in the first place, and thus necessitated the initial intervention, and told him that any attempts to destabilize the world further with an admission of his lie would result in a second and permanent abduction. As time passed, Walker had grown progressively less sure that the aliens had been serious about their threat. It struck him as highly unlikely that they were still keeping tabs after so much time, but he hadn't yet felt an urgent need to test this in any way. On occasion, he had been tempted to bring Joe in on the secret to ensure that the option of revealing it didn't die with him, but on reflection, he realized that Joe had so little mainstream credibility that he would have been as well, scrawling "Walker lied it was a hoax" in brown paint on the wall of an abandoned warehouse. The only other three people who knew Walker's current location were the same three who knew everything else, the McCarthy brothers and Emma Ford. All three continued to surprise him greatly by remaining strong enough and selfless enough to keep it all quiet. Events of the last few days had left Walker feeling uncomfortably and intolerably impotent. For decades, he had enjoyed real power in frontline politics, first as a congressman and ultimately as the long-standing head of the Interspace Defense Agency. But right now, those days seemed a long way away. His elaborate plan to sell a hoax by dressing the lie up as a secret had succeeded in its primary goal of halting China's ambitious plans to colonize the moon and walk on the surface of Mars, two developments which, to his mind, would have unacceptably ceded the ultimate high ground and, in his famous words, surrendered the well-earned national security advantage of the United States. The unfortunate side effect of the hoax, from Walker's point of view, had been the creation of the GSC, a truly supranational organization which brought all national space agencies together under one umbrella. Power creep had always been his main concern when it came to such organizations, and the one saving grace in his eyes was that the GSC at least had a strongly pro-West leader in the form of William Godfrey, whose occasional anti-American comments of the past Walker knew to have been strategic rather than authentic. Nevertheless, Walker wanted the GSC to die. Yesterday. When a meteor entered the Earth's atmosphere and exploded with tremendous force high above the island of Kerguelen, the people of Earth had been powerless to stop it. And with the United States fully signed up to the GSC's charter, all unilateral defensive measures were out of the question. It disgusted Walker that a rich European like Timo Fiori was doing more than President Slater to safeguard the people of the United States and the world at large. Walker didn't buy the theories that the Kerguelen bolide was anything but a coincidence. He also didn't buy the theory that it was a close call, as many had been calling it. Like Tunguska and Chelyabinsk, he saw it instead as a warning for humanity to get its act together. A meteor today, and what tomorrow? Walker was asking the question, but it seemed to him like no one else was. And if things continued the way they were going, with a corrupt and bloated GSC prohibiting anyone else from doing anything to protect the planet while its mechanisms did the square root of nothing, he would have no choice but to do something. At 4 a.m., he decided it was time for a test run. Walker coughed dryly, grimacing and holding the throat, which had recently begun to fail him so completely. His loyal old dog, Rooster, walked to his side as he always did when the coughing got bad. Walker patted the dog's head and told him it was okay. He then picked up his phone and dialed Joe Crabb's number. It rang and rang, but there was no answer.
"One of these days," he said after the beep, coughing again to clear his treacherous throat, and in doing so destroying his initial effort to sound intimidating. "One of these days or nights, I'm going to need you to answer on the first ring so we can set up an urgent live interview. You know I don't have many days left, Joe. What you don't know is that there's something I want to get off my chest before the last one comes."
Friday. C-73. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. With Henry and Clark at their respective workplaces, both motivated by their shared need to do something productive rather than any pressing need for money, Emma and Dan sat in the McCarthys' living room, talking openly about an offer she had received overnight. Emma had awoken to dozens of missed calls on her phone, all of them from Timo Fiori. Unlike Dan, who had once again spent most of the night awake and paying too much attention to the news, Emma was unaware of Timo's problem until he finally got hold of her. At that point, his pleas for assistance were immediate, as he told her of his inability to deal with the sudden and massive flood of negative media attention that had recently come his way. On the back of some innocuously intended comments during his reciprocity announcement, Timo explained that he now stood accused in the court of social media, with the charges ranging from cultural chauvinism to intentional insensitivity. The story of the outrage had grown arms and legs in the few hours since the first posts went viral, and Emma could hear in Timo's voice that he was personally hurt by the criticisms more than he was concerned about their effect on his project. The chief complaint centered on Timo's use of humanity's move from mud huts and igloos to cities full of skyscrapers as an example of civilizational progress. The specific charges, he gloomily relayed, were of willfully erasing the experience of everyone who didn't live in a Western city and of stigmatizing the living arrangements of millions of people. His insistence on using only English in written captions and communications was another easy target for those with time on their hands and axes to grind. Timo had made no public comment as yet, but insisted to Emma in a weary tone that he intended no cultural bias. He cited the fact that he included several Emirati buildings in his example materials, despite his well-known dislike of the governments and building practices behind them, and said that he did so because the buildings were technically impressive and that all he was looking for were the best examples of human construction. Emma let him talk for a while without interrupting. He had also faced criticism for his refusal to leave Reciprocity's plaque design process to a truly open vote, and particularly for using the word "heard" in reference to the general public. This was indefensible, the critics claimed, and a clear sign of Fiori's elitist detachment from reality. Eventually, Emma spoke. She told Timo that the best course of action was to do and say nothing,
explaining that no one beyond the fringe of the fringe was truly upset by his comments. The cookie-cutter headlines claiming that he was under fire and being blasted for comments that had sparked fury were nothing more than the dying echoes of desperate clickbait-peddling media outlets. Unlike in the bygone days when news outlets survived by earning repeat customers through quality content, Emma told him, the new model's goal was to generate clicks at any cost. It's like an arms race of who can push these clickbait headlines furthest, she said. Today it's just your turn to be the target. Timo was quiet for several seconds. You know I trust your instincts, he eventually replied. But this feels different. I have said some foolish things in my life, Emma, far more foolish than this. I have also collected a lot of enemies over the years, some earned and some not, but no one has ever thrown these kinds of accusations at me. I have never seen a reaction like this. The articles are calling for apologies, boycotts, you name it. It's hysteria. Exactly, Emma said. It is hysteria. So why take it personally? Aside from a tiny, tiny, tiny handful of people who have picked this as the thing they're going to be offended about today, most of what you're seeing is purely driven by so-called news sites that make money every time someone clicks a link. That's all it is. I know it's difficult for you right now, but it's a pretty simple thing to understand, and this isn't something that's going to last. My media team at Fiori Frontieri are telling me that no one had mentioned any of this until around 6 hours ago, Timo replied, his tone calmer than before, but his concerns not yet abated. And apparently it happened in one sudden moment. A barrage of identically worded posts went out from various accounts on various platforms. Then, as soon as the ball was rolling, the new accounts which posted the first comments were deleted. I think Godfrey and his people did this, and I want proof. It might have been astroturfed outrage, Emma conceded, with strong emphasis on the might. And it definitely wouldn't be the first time I've seen something like that. But seriously, Timo, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter what started it. I've seen the situation a million times with a million clients, and my advice is always the same. Turn the other cheek. I know it's hard to keep perspective when people are throwing accusations at you, but honestly, no one really cares about this stuff. 99% of people will roll their eyes at it, but they still click the headlines. That's the new game. The gutter-dwelling journalists write the stupidest headlines they can, and then regular people get annoyed at what they think other people are offended by. But no one except a tiny handful of people were even offended in the first place. I've had to think about this stuff a lot because social media changed the PR game just as I was learning it. I don't know how else to put it except to say that saying nothing is the quickest way out. Seriously, the only way to win is to not play. We can't let them win, Timo protested. We can't let him win. Timo, they're not winning anything. They're crawling around in the mud and trying to pull you down there with them. You're taking this personally because you're a nice guy and you're not the things they're calling you, but what I'm telling you is that no one actually thinks you are. Just stay dignified and it'll blow over. What had become clearer and clearer to Emma with each of Timo's comments was that he really was more upset by the personal nature of the accusations than he was concerned with the effect they might have on his reciprocity project. But while she had been trying to comfort him, Emma had also been scanning the most recent related articles. Only one development troubled her in relation to its possible effect on Timo's public image. But it troubled her a great deal. Already, barely missing a beat, John Cole had performed an uninvited and unwelcome leap to Timo's defense with a series of typically brash and deliberately inflammatory assertions. Reciprocity is a message from civilization to civilization, Cole had said in a short televised interview. And what the thought police who have been badgering poor Timo have to accept is that the sender is Western civilization. We want to show skyscrapers, athletes, and physicists, not mud huts, cannibals, and witch doctors. If people have a problem with that, I don't know what to tell them. As Emma told Timo after reading this, John Cole was the only part of this problem that wouldn't fade away on its own. Jack Neal had clearly advised Cole that latching on to the reciprocity controversy was a good way of leeching some of Timo's goodwill with the public, and Emma knew that the skunk-like taint they could leave on Timo was something that had to be actively dealt with. The good news is that we can take care of Cole once and for all on Sunday, she said. Jack is going to be on the Focus 2020 panel as a proxy, so we'll deal with him then. And if anything comes to light about Godfrey being behind this little outrage storm, we'll have the chance to take care of him in New York, too. You can let your people look into that just as long as they don't make any strong comments until they run it all by us. And in the meantime, don't let this run you down, okay? I'll see you tomorrow in Denver when your plane touches down.
About that, Timo said, how would you feel about coming back with me to Italy for a few days after the show on Sunday? I have some important press engagements to take care of before my move to Colorado, and they would be much easier if you were here.
You're moving here?
Of course. Fiori Frontieri isn't going to run itself, and the old IDA building was the obvious choice for our global headquarters. I would say, you can't buy that kind of symbolism, but it turns out that you can.
Emma was quiet for several seconds.
I know you don't like flying, Emma, so you must know that I wouldn't ask if I didn't need you. It will only be for a few days, and I would be delighted if Dan wants to come with you.
And so, minutes after taking Timo's call, Emma had ended it without committing either way. She brought the offer to Dan as soon as Henry and Clark were gone for the day, and much to her surprise, he wasn't totally against the idea of her going.
You can come with me too, she said. That would be better.
To her even greater surprise, Dan was totally against this suggestion. When she asked why, his answer, I have to be here in case something happens, only led to another obvious question, like what? What do you think might happen that you'd need to be here for?
Dan shrugged. Another bolide, maybe? Or maybe something more direct if they finally plant the fourth plaque? They might call me somewhere, and I doubt it would be in Italy.
What makes you think they might call you somewhere? Have you felt anything since Kerguelen?
Emma asked, with an interest bordering on concern.
You know, in your neck?
No, nothing like that. It's just a strong hunch. But you don't have to worry about anything. You can leave all my fancy birthday presents wrapped somewhere I can find them, and Clark will be here if I need help with anything. And Tara will be here too, right?
After laughing at Dan's comment about the birthday presents, Emma's expression turned to stone.
I'll pretend you didn't just say that last part.
I didn't mean I'm going to tell her, Dan said with a slight smile. I like Tara too much to dump this on her, even if I wanted to. Clark will be here if I need help with anything like that. I just meant that Tara will be here too, so it's not like I'll need to keep a close eye on your house while you're gone.
Ah, Emma sighed, leaning back in thought.
I hadn't even thought of that. When Tara is home alone, someone does need to keep an eye on things. I'll ask Clark, and I swear, if she tries to have any parties while I'm gone...
So you are going?
If you're sure you're okay with that. It's not like I'm desperate to go or anything. I wouldn't go for free, and I wouldn't go at all if it wasn't to help Timo. But if you think that you might need help here, then obviously I...
It's okay, Dan said. Go.
Definitely?
Dan nodded slowly.
I will miss having you around, but Timo is on our side. Even though he doesn't know everything, he's always been on our side. If we can help him, if you can help him, I think we should. Remember how much he helped us?
Of course I do. But if you do need help with anything, whatever it is, day or night, you call me, okay? My phone is always on and you'll always get straight through. Day or night.
Day or night, Dan said. Understood.
Emma smiled.
And for the record, I'll miss you having me around too.
A few seconds later, she returned Timo's call and told him she was in.
C-72. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan was grateful when a mundane phone call from Clark broke up his afternoon, consisting, as it had, of staring at his wall-length research board in the hope that the missing piece of the Kerguelen puzzle would flow from his mind in a flash of inspiration. It hadn't. With Clark still at work and Emma now home after a short trip to the city, but apparently not answering his calls, Clark asked Dan to pop next door and pass on an invitation. It came from Phil Norris, upon hearing that Emma had only one more night in Birchwood before heading to New York, and ultimately Italy with Timo Fiori, he had kindly invited everyone to the bar for some free drinks to see her off. Dan agreed to pass on the message. He waited until 4 o'clock, when Emma's usual at-home workdays came to an end, then began the 15-second walk from his home to hers. He had been counting down the minutes until 4 o'clock, even before Clark's call, keen to catch up with her for what would be one of the last times in a while. Dan didn't take any notice of the old blue car parked right outside. Subconsciously, he knew that Emma's sister, Tara, was due back in town soon, and he wasn't paying nearly enough attention to notice that it didn't look shiny or expensive enough to be something she would be seen dead driving. He knocked twice on the door, as he always did, and was surprised by how quickly Emma answered. He was also surprised by her noticeably flustered demeanor. "Hey," she said, trying to force an upbeat smile, "what's up?" After saying a few words about the message he was supposed to pass on for Clark, Dan noticed something over Emma's shoulder. A young man of around his age, sitting on the couch in a well-filled-out black muscle shirt. "Is something wrong?" Emma asked.
It was nothing," Dan replied, backing away. "I didn't know you were busy."
Emma watched in confusion for a few seconds as he turned around and began to walk away. She then glanced back to the couch and understood.
"Dan, wait."
"It's fine," he said. "Really, you don't have to. He's here for Tara." Dan stopped.
"Oh, I didn't know she'd arrived."
"Come on inside," Emma said, her expression having gone from confusion to amusement as the misunderstanding developed, quickly turned sour.
"She hasn't arrived yet, and that's the whole thing. Apparently she told this guy she'd be here an hour ago and that I'd be happy to let him inside if she was late, which sure sounds like her."
Dan grinned slightly. From the few times he'd met Tara, that did sound like her. Emma leaned in to whisper before they stepped inside.
"But don't worry, I searched and scanned him."
"For what?" Dan whispered back.
"Bugs, obviously. I took his phone too. You do understand why we can't let random people into our houses, right?"
Dan nodded, pretending he would have been so thorough. He made a mental note to make sure that he was next time, not that he ever had visitors. As soon as Dan stepped inside, the young man on the couch leapt to his feet.
"Holy shit, it's Dan McCarthy!"
"Sure is," Dan replied. He then looked at the man's outstretched hand and tried to act like he was familiar with the odd angle of a sports-style handshake.
"I'm Jay. My sister loves you, dude. I mean, I like you too, but you know, not like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, you know, I just mean, like, it's...
relax," Dan said. He himself had turned into a bumbling or dumbstruck idiot on a few occasions when he met people he knew from the TV. His meeting with Richard Walker during a school trip to the IDA building around 8 years earlier jumped to mind as a good example, but it still didn't really compute in his mind that he was now the person from the TV whose presence drove other people to either freeze up or ask for autographs and photos.
"So how long have you known Tara?" he asked, trying to settle the poor guy's nerves.
Jay hesitated and scanned the room for a clock.
"Probably like 6 or 7 hours," he said.
"And she invited him into my house," Emma said to Dan, as though Jay wasn't there. "And you wonder why I give her a hard time."
"I can leave," Jay said. Emma motioned with her hand for him to sit back down.
"It's not your fault. I didn't mean that. Besides, you've already waited this long."
"Thanks," Jay said. He then turned back to Dan. "So, my sister would kill me if she knew I was here and didn't ask this. Do you remember her? Debbie Butcher?"
"Debbie Butcher?" Dan echoed.
"Of course I remember her. She was in almost all of my classes. If she's your sister, then I think I remember you too. Jay Butcher, you played football, right? You were only 2 years below me."
Jay's eyes lit up, and he looked up at the ceiling, shaking his head in disbelief before talking more to himself than anyone else.
"I cannot believe Dan McCarthy knows who I am."
"Why did you cut your hair?" Dan asked. "I would have known you straight away with the long hair." Emma gently pulled Dan's arm, encouraging him towards the relative privacy of the kitchen.
"So, do you want Debbie's number?" Jay asked.
"Yeah, Dan,"
Emma said, teasing him with a parroting tone and a gentle elbow in the back.
"Do you want Debbie's number?"
"Oh, shit. Sorry," Jay said. "I didn't know you guys were... yeah,
My bad. Dan and Emma looked at each other silently for several seconds. Dan didn't know what she was thinking, but he guessed it was the same as him and that she didn't want to be the one to shout, "We're not," in a way that could only offend the other.
"Do you want to say it, or should I?"
she whispered through a smile, confirming that she was indeed thinking more or less the same thing. Dan tipped his head forward slightly. "We're not," Emma said, eventually getting it out. Jay didn't even try to hide his confusion.
"So was that a yes to wanting my sister's number?"
"I'm not really looking for anything like that," Dan said. He was then relieved by the sound of the front door opening to save him from any awkward follow-up questions. Tara Ford, with all the effortless presence of her older sister, walked inside with the handle of a wheeled suitcase in one hand and an expensive-looking bottle of coconut water in the other.
"Sorry I'm late,"
she said, only to Jay.
"No problem," he said, standing to greet her.
But Tara then noticed Dan standing next to Emma at the entrance to the kitchen and seemed to forget all about Jay as she hurried over towards them.
"Dan," she said with a warm hug, "there's my favorite person who lives in Birchwood."
"Resident," Emma said. "The word you're looking for is resident."
Tara let go of Dan and turned to Emma.
"And there's my third favorite."
Emma mocked a smile.
"Very good. Put your suitcase away and wait in my room. There are a few things I need to make sure you understand."
"What crawled up your ass and died?"
Tara asked. Emma took the suitcase from Tara's hand and carried it away.
"So, anyway,"
Tara smiled, holding her hands out and moving them until they were several feet apart.
"I still have a list of names this long, Dan, and they're not just models this time. Some of them are nice girls, like me."
As Tara flashed a smile, Dan couldn't deny that she certainly had her charms. It wasn't difficult to see why she was doing well as a model, but even she couldn't have denied that she'd benefited a lot from the notoriety of her last name, as well as by looking a lot like a younger version of her universally recognized sister. The biggest difference between them was the accent, and this had been what Dan noticed most the first time he met Tara. Despite having been raised by the same parents while living in Georgia for her whole life, and despite not having spent 10 years in the upper echelons of New York's cutthroat publicity industry like Emma had, Tara's voice barely had a hint of a twang in contrast to Emma's soft but strong southern accent. Dan could only assume that she had ditched it on purpose.
"I meant now," Emma said firmly from her bedroom door.
"I'll just be a sec," Tara called to Jay, signaling that she hadn't forgotten about him. He nodded in acknowledgement.
"I'll see you again soon, Dan,"
Tara said, hugging him again.
"I'm gonna be in town for a while."
"That's nice," Emma said, walking back over.
"Where did you say you were staying again?"
Tara let out a mock sigh in Dan's direction as she headed to Emma's bedroom for her imminent reprimand. She then held out her hands again, reminding him of the length of her list. Back at Dan's side, Emma asked if the message he had from Clark was too private to talk about right now. Dan shook his head briskly, only then remembering that he had a message at all.
"It was just that Phil is offering free drinks for everyone since you're leaving tonight. Clark wants to go, obviously. He said he couldn't get hold of you on your phone."
"It's just because his number doesn't get straight through during work hours. I guess I should change that. But yeah, definitely, I could do with blowing off some steam. Are you coming too?"
"No," Dan said very flatly. He didn't have to explain why. Emma knew that he hadn't been comfortable being around more than a few people at once ever since the weight of the secret landed on his shoulders, and the presence of Jay meant that he couldn't have safely done so anyway.
"But I'll see you tomorrow, when you're going to the airport."
"Definitely,"
Emma said. She walked with Dan towards the front door.
"See you later," Dan said to Jay.
"Yeah, dude, I hope so. Before you go, can I just ask, like, personally, what do you think this Kerguelen thing is all about? Everyone is sort of moving on from it already, but it can't be nothing, right? I mean, that place is so small. And for Kendrick to be there at the exact moment it happened? I don't know. Do you think there's more going on than we understand?"
Surprising everyone, Tara interjected from halfway across the house.
"I think someone understands it," she said. "I definitely think there's something that someone's not telling us."
Emma shrugged dismissively.
"And since you've never been wrong before..."
At that point, Jay chimed in again for a momentary silence to redirect the question squarely at Dan.
So, what do you think, dude?
Your guess is as good as mine, Dan said, and he left it at that. Emma opened the door and very briefly joined Dan outside to deliver a firm piece of advice that tonally came close to being more of an order than a suggestion.
I don't want you talking to Tara until I get home.
Why? Dan asked. It was the obvious question.
You heard her. She thinks someone knows something, and if she has even the slightest, tiniest suspicion that the someone might be you, she'll get the something out of you before you even know what's going on. She is so much smarter and sneakier than she lets on. If you let your guard down around Tara for a second, whoever you are, she'll get whatever it is that she wants from you and you won't even know she's got it.
Dan's expression conveyed his doubt with no need for words. The last time Tara had come to visit, Emma had encouraged him to think about what his actions of the previous year had ultimately done for Tara's career. By making Emma famous, it was the IDA leak that had in turn given Tara something to capitalize on by virtue of sharing Emma's last name and looking uncannily like she had 10 years earlier. Dan still didn't really think this was why Tara was always nice to him, but he hadn't forgotten the words.
I know you don't see any of that craftiness when you look at her, Emma went on, but you don't see it when you look at me either. You only see the good in people. That's not a bad thing, Dan, but it can be a dangerous thing, okay? And I'm not saying Tara would do anything to hurt you, to hurt us, but I really, really, really don't want her to know. Being worried about who she might tell is the main reason, but I also don't want her to have to bear this weight on her shoulders. Sure, she's difficult, but she's still my little sister. I still care about her.
So do I, Dan said. That's exactly what I said this morning. I like Tara way too much to bring her in on this. She doesn't deserve to have to deal with any of this. Emma nodded keenly.
Okay, however you want to frame it, just as long as she doesn't find out.
You'll only be gone for a few days anyway, Dan said.
That's right.
Emma smiled, putting her hand on the door to go back inside.
I'll be halfway back before you even know I'm gone.
C-71. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Alone again with his impatient thoughts and his extensive, some might say obsessive, wall-length research board, Dan McCarthy was starting to get physically uncomfortable. It was like an itch he couldn't scratch, like a question with no answer. He had too much faith in the messengers to think they would ever test him like this on purpose by getting his attention and then making him wait 2 full days for a follow-up, and his frustration became self-exacerbating when he began to consider that perhaps it was him who had to make the next move, that he was missing something that was already there, and that no second clue was coming. At this point, the absence of new supporting evidence even had Dan questioning his most basic existing assumption, that the Kerguelen bolide was the first event in a series, which would lead to the discovery of a new message engraved on the famously elusive fourth plaque. The media, evidently disappointed by their broad failure to turn the Kerguelen bolide into a fear-inspiring event, had almost entirely moved on. A few minutes here and there was the extent of the airtime the event now received, usually when a new piece of tangible information about the meteor's composition or trajectory was officially announced. Several high-profile antidotalists, a group of self-loathing humans who saw their species as a scourge to be eradicated, had taken to the internet to lambaste Timo's plan to spread the human virus into space through his Fiori Frontieri venture. No one paid much attention to these individuals, who were roundly dismissed as smug pseudo-intellectuals with too much time in their hands and not enough brain cells in their heads, and Dan considered the fact that they were getting so much coverage as indicative of the lack of tangible news to report. Some leading American reporters had decried in increasingly firm terms the lack of dialogue coming from once communicative facilities in Texas and Florida, contrasting the coordinated silence of today with the relative openness of the halcyon days before the NASA signage gave way to the GSC's logo and flag. But in the last few minutes, one particular public figure had gone significantly further by uttering a simple phrase that was already going viral. GSC cover-up. The man was Billy Kendrick, and Dan's mood was lifted. As Billy broadcast a live podcast from his ship, currently somewhere deep inside the Antarctic Circle, Dan nodded his head in stronger agreement with each passing word. Billy dismissed the supposedly newsworthy diplomatic fallout from the clash between GSC security staff and foreign tourists at Lake Namso as a deliberate diversion tactic. He even went as far as to question the wisdom of his friend Timo Fiori's decision to announce the extensive Fiori Frontieri space program when he did. In Billy's words, Timo's press conference had been a positive development and eminently well-intentioned, but a distraction nevertheless from the main issue at hand. That main issue, as Billy saw it, and as Dan quickly agreed, was that the GSC's absolute monopoly on space-based observation meant that they alone were privy to the true details of the bolide's behavior. "I trust William Godfrey about as far as I could throw John Cole," Billy quipped, "and I trust his GSC about as much as I trusted Richard Walker's IDA. I know what I saw on the island of Kerguelen, and all the fake data in the world can't change what I saw and what I felt." Dan now realized that without knowing the true nature of the explosion above Kerguelen, he couldn't know anything else. If Billy was right, this could be the missing piece. An objective analysis of the meteor itself could provide all kinds of clues, with countless variables ranging from its material composition and explosive yield to the precise times and locations of its entry and explosion, all potentially being part of a larger coded message. "I believe that a cover-up of almost unprecedented proportions could well be underway in Buenos Aires as we speak," Billy said. "I don't have to explain why I'm using the term almost unprecedented, and right now, just like at the IDA, all we need is a smoking gun. All we need is a new Dan McCarthy, someone willing to put their neck on the line and get the truth out there, whatever the personal consequences might be. I understand that Timo can't put up an offer for information this time, at least not without sending himself to jail, but right now I'm making a moral appeal to everyone at the GSC. My appeal is simple. Tell the truth. If you know something, tell someone. For all we know, everything could depend on it. Godfrey wouldn't lie for you, so stop lying for him." Stirred by Billy's words, and even more so by what they meant, that the answers to the questions plaguing his mind might already be out there, just waiting to be found, Dan rose from his chair and approached his research board with newfound energy. His first move was to pick a new black pin from the box and place it as close as he could to the GSC's impenetrable Buenos Aires HQ. He then walked to the right-hand side of the long board and lifted a magnetic portrait of GSC Chairman William Godfrey from the pile of potentially important figures. Dan pinned Godfrey's smug face right next to Kerguelen, then stepped back and took it all in. Billy might not have the answer just yet, Dan thought to himself. But he's asking the right questions. C-minus 70. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. Inside the relatively quiet bar area of New Care Grillin Bar and Grill, Emma and Clark sat alone at a small booth in the corner while Henry and his friends chatted merrily at the bar. The whole group had spent a few hours together, making the most of Phil Norris's offer of free drinks, as Emma tried not to show her annoyance at the constant questions about what was really going on and what Timo Fiore was going to do about it. She understood the curiosity but struggled to hide her disappointment that a rare night out she'd hoped to use to blow off some steam had gone in this direction. Fortunately for Emma, as the night wore on and the beer kicked in, the trio of Henry, Phil, and Walter Byrd had gradually lost interest in all of that and returned to their usual intra-group ribbing and loud retellings of familiar stories from years and decades gone by. Clark would have been happy enough to stick with the guys, but saw the bored look on Emma's face and immediately announced that he wanted to move to the booth for a while to give his back a break from his bar stool. "We'll leave you old boys to your old stories for a while," he said. When he got Emma alone in the relatively private booth, the other patrons knew better than to get too close without asking, Clark repeated several times that he wasn't too hot on the idea of her going to Italy without him there to act as her security.
He was also completely unwilling to leave Dan alone in Colorado, and well aware that Dan wouldn't entertain the idea of going to Italy, so it took a phone call with Timo to ease his mind with assurances that sufficient security would be in place. Emma appreciated Clark's concern, but told him that she wasn't stupid and would stick to the same rules as on their last visit to see Timo, including never getting inside a vehicle without him. Timo asked Clark a few general questions during their brief call and played coy when Clark asked him about Billy Kendricks' recent claim of a GSC cover-up.
"It is true that they have all of the data gathered from orbital equipment," Timo said, "and it is true that I am not in a position to safely offer a bounty for a leak like I did last year. But having said that, Clark, I think we both know by now that the truth has a way of getting out, don't we?"
Emma and Clark didn't discuss any of that business between themselves, focusing instead on more domestic matters, like how Clark was settling into his police work, and later on the firm rules that Emma had laid down for Tara. While picking up some empty glasses from another booth, Phil Norris overheard part of a laughter-filled story Emma was telling about Tara and pulled his bar stool towards them. Phil noticed Clark looking over at the other two empty bar stools and explained that Henry and Mr. Bird were ordering some food from the grill. Phil, apparently starting to feel the effects of his own generous hospitality, waved his finger between the two of them while smiling like a loon.
"You know what's funny?" he said, chuckling long before he got there. "Now that Tara is back in town, if you all paired off, you boys could end up being brothers and brothers-in-law. Same for Emma and Tara, sisters and sisters-in-law."
"That kind of thing might fly where they're from," Clark quipped. "But Birchwood ain't Georgia."
Emma kicked him under the table, begrudgingly laughing along with him.
"It might sound hard to believe," she said, "but Tara has done a lot worse than you."
Clark, still a long way from feeling any loosening effects from all the free drinks, looked confused.
"Obviously none of this is real, but why are you suddenly pairing me with Tara? She's pretty much the same age as Dan. Surely in Phil's imaginary world it would make more sense for me and—"
"I've got to have some standards," Emma cut him off.
This sent Phil into a fresh fit of roaring laughter, but Clark sat quietly and wondered whether Emma had just let something slip. He got his answer before too long, shortly after his decision to call it a night around 15 minutes before closing time, when his better judgment told him that Emma was in danger of reaching a point where she might let something else slip. Phil handed them an almost empty bottle as they left and said that they might as well finish it. Clark shook his hand and thanked him for the free night, while Phil merrily thanked him in return for sticking to the cheap stuff instead of ordering champagne or expensive whiskey. After the very short cab ride home, Emma saw that the light was on in her living room and invited herself into the McCarthy's house.
"I can't handle Tara right now," she explained,
slightly unsteady on her feet as she followed Clark inside.
"Do you want some water?"
he asked as she took a seat at the familiar kitchen table. She shook her head, still holding the almost empty bottle.
"Phil gave us this, and it was only supposed to be free for this one night."
"Fair enough," Clark said.
A few minutes later, he broke a silence that was awkward only from his relatively sober perspective by asking the most general question he could think of.
"So what's going on with Tara anyway?"
"I already told you. She invited a guy to my house without asking," Emma said.
Her eyes then widened in a sudden but oddly tired kind of way.
"Wait a second. Do you know anyone called Debbie Butcher?"
"I know of her," Clark shrugged. "I think she was in Dan's year at school. I didn't know her back then, obviously, because when I was their age, they were in middle school. I heard she moved back here from Texas or something last year. She left again, though, just to the city this time. Why are you asking?"
"Does Dan ever talk about her?"
Clark let out a half-laugh, half-groan, and reached across the table for what was left in Emma's bottle.
"I think we've had enough of this for one night. Water?"
She nodded sleepily.
"Good choice," Clark said. "And I'm only going to say this once, okay? I'm only going to say it once because it isn't exactly my area of expertise, and I'm only going to say it at all
because I care about both of you. So here it is. None of us are in middle school anymore. If you've got something to tell Dan, you've got to tell Dan that thing. But only if you mean it, okay? Emma didn't answer. Clark turned around from the sink, glass of water in hand, and saw that her eyes were closed and her head was tipped peacefully forward. He gently lifted her from the armless kitchen chair and laid her down on the couch with her head propped up by two cushions. Henry returned from the now closed bar just as Clark was doing this. "I think she just had a little bit too much of the bar," Clark explained. Henry was grinning from ear to ear. "So did Phil," he laughed, holding up an unopened bottle of whiskey. "He wouldn't let me leave without taking this."
C-69. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. William Godfrey, maintaining an outward expression of calm despite the troubles which were piling up around him, once again stood at the end of the long table in his meeting room. This time his audience consisted solely of media advisors. There were no science advisors who he had politely asked to stay away until they could bring him something concrete, and who were all under close watch, having been asked to stay quiet about Kerguelen. All they knew so far was that an internal memo from the GSC's senior analysis team had described the Kerguelen event as observably unnatural, but Godfrey knew that such knowledge was more than enough to cause problems should it fall into the wrong hands. Godfrey had little faith in the memo writer's objectivity and expected that the decisive data he was waiting for, whenever it came, would pour cold water on what he saw as subjective speculation. They wanted it to look unnatural, he told himself, and that was why their findings thus far were supposedly consistent with such a notion. What Godfrey had even less faith in, however, was the silence of the many people who had seen the memo before he quietly ordered a halt to its dissemination. Thinking back to the previous year, he saw only too much irony when considering Richard Walker's hand-waving statement that it could never be possible to cover something up within an organization as large as his IDA. Given that the GSC employed more staff by several orders of magnitude, Godfrey could only hope that he'd managed to close the stable door before the memo-carrying horse had bolted. And, as if he needed another thorn in his side, Billy Kendrick had just publicly called on any GSC staff with illuminating information about the Kerguelen bolide to come forward. This was on Godfrey's mind as his media advisors happily discussed their success in tainting the discourse around Timo Fiori's newly announced space program by accusing him of cultural insensitivity. The greater victory, as they made sure Godfrey knew, was that John Cole had been baited into replying just as they'd hoped, thus aligning Godfrey's enemies and making them easier to take down in one fell swoop when the time came. "The only disappointment so far is that we haven't been able to force an apology out of Timo," one of the advisors said, "or even a defensive reply. If he doesn't say anything and instead chooses to rise above it, there's only so much mileage in this." "We have tried to ramp it up," another advisor added, "with calls for boycotts of the firms he works with and all the other usual tactics. But nothing so far has been enough to bait him."
"It never will be," Godfrey replied.
"What do you mean, sir? Why do you think he isn't saying anything about this?"
"Because someone a lot smarter than any of you is telling him not to," Godfrey said. He straightened his tie and looked pensively out of the window. "And I have a pretty good idea of who that someone might be."
C-68. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan didn't see the funny side of anything when he walked out of his basement in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. Henry and Clark were laughing loudly at something on TV. Clark was obviously drunk, and Emma was out for the count on the couch. "Clark," he said, speaking quietly but with a firm enough tone to usher him over. When Clark was standing in front of him, he continued, "What the hell is going on?" After a few seconds, Clark shrugged dismissively as though the obvious answer was nothing. Dan then pointed to Clark's room and made a zip-across-the-lips gesture. Clark knew what he meant, go to bed before you say something stupid,
and he was tired enough to think that it wasn't worth arguing.
"Sure thing, boss," he said with only a hint of sarcasm.
Dan walked over to Emma and tried to wake her up, starting quietly and saying her name progressively more loudly.
"What are you doing?" Henry asked. "Look at her. She's peaceful."
"I'm taking her home. She doesn't want to wake up here," Dan said. He looked around at the empty cans and food containers. Clark would clean it all up in the morning and do a good job of it, like he always did, but the place was a pigsty in the meantime.
"A cockroach wouldn't want to wake up here."
Henry laughed again while Dan kept talking in Emma's ear and tapping her cheek with his finger until she woke up.
"Huh?" she said, squinting. "Oh, Dan, where have you been all night?"
"Let's just get you home," he replied. "You've got a flight in less time than you want to know."
Emma was fairly steady on her feet, despite sounding less lucid than Dan had ever heard her, but not steady enough for him to let her go alone. She didn't fight him on that, gladly letting him guide her outside and then into her own dark house. Dan left her at her bedroom door and went to get her a glass of water for the rest of the night. When he returned, she was still fully clothed and lying on the bed rather than in it.
"Don't go yet,"
she said as Dan moved to the door after placing the glass on her bedside table. She sat up, which took a visible effort, and patted the bed beside her, encouraging Dan to sit. He did.
"Why?"
"Just because," Emma said.
She wrapped her arms loosely around his neck and clasped her hands. Dan was laughing at how glazed over her eyes were until they closed. He was laughing until her lips tightened and moved slowly towards his. At that point, he pulled her hands away from his neck and stood up in one quick movement. "No," was all he said. Emma lay back on the bed and looked at him with wide but tired eyes.
"Why?"
"Because you're wasted."
She rolled over to face the wall.
"Is that the only reason?"
"Just get some sleep, okay? I'll see you in the morning."
"I won't remember any of this in the morning," Emma said.
Dan laughed slightly, awkwardly, in the absence of a suitable reply.
"Unless you remind me,"
she added, her voice growing distant in the final moments before she fell asleep. Dan closed the bedroom door most of the way and walked towards the front door.
"Boo,"
a soft voice called from behind him. He turned around. Tara.
"Don't worry, I didn't hear any of that,"
she said, walking out from her own room just next to Emma's. "I only heard all of it."
"You're a good guy, you know that?"
"How long have you been here?" Dan asked, too surprised to think of any other reply.
"A few hours. I wasn't out for long. That guy was almost okay, but, well, not so much. You know when someone turns out to be nothing like what you expected?"
"Not really."
Tara's face brightened up.
"That's what I like about you. Anyone else would just say, yeah, I know what you mean, but you're so straight down the line all the time. My life would be so much easier if they were all like you, Dan McCarthy."
The lighthearted way Tara said his full name was more than a little unnerving to Dan. It was so like the chirpy, sing-song voice Emma used to use when she was working for XPR and trying to gain his trust, it may as well have been a recording being played back. It seemed to him like Tara's natural accent was creeping back in now that it was so late and she wasn't thinking about it.
"Do you want to stay for a drink or something?" Tara went on.
Dan inched towards the door and shook his head. "I'm pretty tired. Maybe some other time."
"I'll hold you to that."
"I said maybe some other time." Tara laughed.
"You know, sometimes I can't work you out."
"There's not a whole lot to work out," Dan said.
"See, that's what I mean. Has anyone ever told you you're too honest?"
"Not as often as you might think,"
Tara grinned.
"So are you going to tell her what just happened? What just, you know, almost happened?"
Dan shook his head.
"The guy who owns the bar was giving her and Clark free drinks all night. She didn't know what she was saying. I don't think she even knew where she was."
"So you're not always honest," Tara said.
This time Dan hesitated. He was by now standing on the doorstep.
Sometimes telling someone the whole truth isn't always the right thing to do. Are you going to tell her?
I'm really good at keeping secrets, Tara replied, throwing in a mischievous wink for good measure. She then broke into a very honest laugh. Especially from Emma. Lifetime of experience, you know? Anyway, night, Dan. Stay sweet.
She closed the door quietly but quickly, saving him the trouble of a reply. C-67. 10 Downing Street, London, England. Unable to sleep, John Cole paced his office like a caged bear. Now that William Godfrey was on the defensive, following not only Timo Fiori's statement of intent to compete in the arena of space research, but also Billy Kendrick's claim that the full details of the Kerguelen bolide were being hidden from the public, Cole was more desperate than ever to publicly prod the GSC chairman. Recent comments from Billy, normally no ally of Cole, had captured the public's imagination and nudged the narrative's direction towards that of the kind seen a year earlier. Now, to Cole's delight, there was talk of cover-ups and leaks, as well as comparisons between Godfrey's GSC and the pariah-like Richard Walker's IDA. Dan McCarthy hadn't yet waded in to pile further pressure on Godfrey, but Emma Ford's presence at Timo's side ahead of Sunday's Focus 2020 panel offered Cole a modicum of hope that this might change. Jack Neal, Cole's right-hand man, was currently on the way to New York to take his own place on that very panel, and Cole had high hopes for how it would all turn out. For very different reasons, Godfrey was a common enemy of both John Cole and Timo Fiori, and as the panel drew nearer, Cole felt quietly confident that Emma would encourage Timo to take a pragmatic approach along the lines of the famous old axiom, "My enemy's enemy is my friend." Godfrey, as an apparent concealer of truth, was also an enemy of Billy Kendrick, another panelist, who would be appearing via satellite, and more importantly, of the individual with more public goodwill than any other well-known figure Cole could think of, Dan McCarthy. Jack was an expert at forging profitable alliances, however temporary, and he had already encouraged Cole to take heart from the fact that Timo hadn't distanced himself from Cole's supportive comments over the reciprocity controversy. Cole glanced at his alarm clock and saw that the morning's hour was no longer all that small. It was now an hour which could be fairly described as either very late or very early. "It's still late," he decided, crawling into bed for a better-than-nothing rest. A devious smile then crossed his face. For whatever the hour, Godfrey's days on top were well and truly numbered. Saturday. C-66. Interstate 25, en route to Denver, Colorado. Dan insisted on driving Emma to the airport. A cab wouldn't have allowed them to talk privately, and although she surprised him greatly by looking and sounding as fresh as a daisy, with no visible after-effects of the night before, Emma was the first to admit that she probably wasn't safe to drive. Clark, most definitely feeling the effects of a night which had gone on for several hours longer than Emma's, sat quietly in the back seat throughout the journey, having come along so he could talk to Timo before his private jet left for its one-night stopover in New York before continuing on to Italy. Tara wasn't invited and didn't offer to join them, though she did wave them off while earnestly promising that she would be responsible and take care of the house in Emma's absence. She didn't even tease a reveal of what she'd overheard the previous night, which led Dan to believe that she really was good at keeping secrets. Not that he had any desire to test that out with anything less personal and more serious. Conversation was scarce and light as Emma took care of a lot of things on her phone while Dan drove. She relayed that Timo had arrived in Denver and was waiting in his plane, keen to leave for New York as soon as Emma reached him. Dan could hear both sides of the call, and it was evident from Timo's tone, as well as his words, that the controversy surrounding certain elements of his reciprocity probes suggested plaque engravings had really gotten to him.
From Dan's perspective, it seemed like Timo was being almost as overly sensitive as the people who'd written long essays about his clumsy but innocuous choice of words in a language that everyone seemed to forget wasn't his first. The mainstream media attention Dan had seen regarding reciprocity was almost universally positive, including interviews with school teachers who spoke from their classrooms to glowingly describe the excitement of their students.